It's up to you, Ben.
It's all me.
How are we this morning?
Early start, huh?
Wow. Every time this happens, I get early sessions, and I always think, wow, you know, everyone's really sleepy, and must have been out partying last night. But the party's tonight, so let's try it again. How are we this morning? Okay, so I will make very quick warning for you on this. Your voices will be required at the end of this session. So, you know, work them up, you know, loosen your throats, all those kind of things. But you're here this morning to have a look at our session of From Zero to Productivity. And we'll be going through a full setup of an Office 365 tenant on stage, live. And I believe in the description it said birthing an enterprise environment. It won't be that painful, I promise. So my name's Ben Walters. I'm a technical specialist with Microsoft. I work on the Office 365 product day in, day out, and I'm based in Melbourne. We also have...
Hello, I'm Chris O'Connor. I'm from OBS in Melbourne. I'm a technology specialist, a SharePoint solution delivery person. I'm out in the field installing SharePoint, setting up SharePoint. So I'm going to be talking the SharePoint piece.
And I'm Lee Hicken. I'm a tech specialist from Microsoft as well, and I'll be covering off the Exchange piece when we get to that a little later on.
So, before we start, how many people saw the the Office 365 Future Productivity yesterday morning? Cool. So for everyone else who didn't, I apologize. We won't be doing as many slides as we did yesterday. I know the slides are what you're all here to see. Today will be as very little death by PowerPoint as possible, and we'll be flicking through this stuff at a rate that we'll be able to get through hopefully within the hour. So we have one or two slides to get through, and then we'll get back onto demos. So most of this will be demo today. So here's what we'll be looking at. We'll be going through a quick overview, literally a two-slide overview. We'll go through demos of Exchange, setting up a tenant, setting up SharePoint, and then I'll also show you around the activation experience for Office 2010. And by the end of this session, we will have a full Office 365 tenant up and running. So, exactly, excitement. I like it. Keep it going. So for those of you who attended yesterday, I apologize. There will be duplicates of slides from the stuff you saw yesterday as well. It just helps to summarize things and helps connect all the dots. Office 365 is here, and it's really about bringing all of our products from what we had in the BPOS world, which was running on a 2007 platform, up to the 2010 platform. There's also the big addition of Office Professional Plus in there as well as part of that subscription model. So that's really what we'll be looking at today, and we'll be going through showing you each of these products in detail and what it takes to get them up and running. Now, Office 365, you will hear us say this throughout this session, and you'll probably hear it as you continue on through the wonderful world of cloud services. Office 365 is a multi-tenanted service. What this means is that there is a whole bunch of people all sharing the same infrastructure. And the best analogy we had for this, and I kind of spun it up when I was talking yesterday as well, is around an apartment building. You know, at an apartment building, you get your apartment, you're responsible for your apartment, you're responsible for the resources in your apartment, but you're not responsible for getting the gas man in or the water man in to connect water to that building. You're just responsible for the stuff that happens in your tenancy. It's the exact same thing when we look at Office 365. You get a tenant. That tenant has services in it around SharePoint, SharePoint, Exchange, and Link, and you're responsible for managing those services at that tenant level. And so with that means there will be some changes in the way you administer things and where you can get to and what you can do. But if you're thinking about why am I kind of constrained, it's because you're in this multi-tenant environment, and chances are if you looked at the digital wall next to you and banged on it, the person on the other side would probably say, be quiet, we're trying to run a business over here. So so from that perspective, that's what we'll be working with, and I think from there, we're now going to go straight into a demo. So let's flick over to number four, beautiful. And I don't want that one, I want this one. So. This is what we'll be starting with today. I've spun up a little company called Zujo. We're still unsure what they do, but chances are they're much like Homer's internet company when we were talking on The Simpsons, so it doesn't do much, but it just makes money from advertising and popping up in people's faces.
I've heard of a company that does that too.
I think we'll be working with them later as well. So what this is here is the initial sign-up trial page. The reason I wanted to bring this up is that this is, whether you're signing up a trial or a brand new tenant, this is what you will see. Now, we're signing up an enterprise tenant here. In Australia, Microsoft has an exclusive partnership with Telstra. And so for organizations that are running on a smaller business scale or don't have an enterprise agreement with Microsoft, which is the key thing here, they will purchase through Telstra. And so some of this sign-up experience may be a little bit different. But from what we're doing today, I wanted to touch on this. And the key thing I wanted to look at is this new domain name down here. So some people get confused by this, but when we first sign up a tenant, we don't have your domain registration information straight away. We need to give you a dummy domain or at least a placeholder domain that we can provision with. And so that's what this domain here is. So whatever you put in there is your business name. In this case, we're doing zujotected.onmicrosoft.com. That is the placeholder. You can put your own domain over the top of that, and I'll show you what that looks like. But I just wanted to touch on that to start, because that can sometimes cause confusion. This also flows through to the first account that will be provisioned, which will be an administrator account. So that administrator account will have a UPN that is, you know, admin@zujotected.onmicrosoft.com. So rather than going through this and waiting for a couple of little boxes to spin around, we have set one up earlier, as is, you know, good Huey's Cooking Show class. And what we have here is this tenant that has been set up for Zujo. Now, this is literally set up yesterday afternoon. It hasn't been touched since then, bar maybe one or two tweaks, but literally we have this thing up and running, and it's a real live tenant, and you can tell because we're about to expire in 30 days. So first thing I'm going to do here is to go and put in my real domain. So I'm going to click on the domains link in the left-hand side there, and it will come up. Now, you can see I've currently got two domains in there. I have zujo2011.onmicrosoft.com, my placeholder domain. I also have zujo.net, which is also an active domain. We've registered this one in advance just to make sure, in case there are any gremlins sitting out there on the interwebs that want to cause problems, we have something to go with. So, but I'm actually going to put another domain in there. Zujo has a couple of domain names they work with. They work with zujo.net, they work with zujo.info.me, and a couple others as well. So I'm actually going to go and put in my own domain to work on that. So I'm going to put in zujo.info as a new domain. Literally as simple as saying, what's your domain? Do a quick check and make sure you've got the right one. And this will actually bring back the details of the registrar that you've got with that and who that's registered with. You can see I've actually registered that through GoDaddy. And then my next step is to go through and set up the verification process for that domain. Now, this is how we verify you own the domain. The whole task of this is putting in a TXT DNS record on your hoster or on your on-premise DNS server to verify that you own this. That's what this number's for. It's uniquely generated and is needed just for that verification process. So let's go ahead and set up that TXT record now. We'll grab that there. And we'll come over to Zujo, to my daddy, which is, strangely enough, just decided to expire. Hopefully this will...
It's a demo, of course it is.
Has. You know, did I not grab the right one? There we go. So, cool. So I'm on the .info domain. I'm going to go through and add my own DNS in here, and I really hate this interface because it's so busy and cluttered. But we'll flick through to that. We'll manage the zujo.info domain. And all I'm going to do is add a new TXT record into here. So simply come down, say quick add. And look, this will change if you're using a hoster to do this, but you know, depending on what hoster you're using. And so that's my unique URL. Literally say hit save to the zone file, and that TXT record's up and ready for me to go now. It says it may take up to an hour, so I'm just making sure you read this so you don't kind of go, his demo failed because it was his fault. It may take an hour, but chances are every time I've done this, it's worked straight away, so let's hope we can get through on this one today. Okay, so if I was just to let this run, what would happen now is it takes roughly 72 hours for us to go through as Microsoft and verify that domain. We have a batch job that runs in the background, and we'll go on through and verify these domains on your behalf. However, this session is not 72 hours long, and I promise I won't have you sitting in those seats for that long. So we're actually going to go and force this through using PowerShell instead. So up here I have some PowerShell. Literally all I've done in this PowerShell script is to have a couple of errors to start off with. But basically I've gone through and grabbed my credentials just here. So basically, grab my credentials for the Microsoft tenant I'm running on. I've then gone through and connected to the Microsoft online service. And then literally all I'm going to do now is force that confirm domain through. So if I can type, it would be great. And yes, you're looking at me going, if he just pressed up, he'd get the last command he ran. But, you know.
Oh, it's cool.
Exactly, yeah. Fingers crossed, no errors. Cool. That's literally it. So now if I come back to my domain list, and we'll back out of here for a second. Yeah, we'll cancel that. That's fine. We can say, I now have zujo.net, and it's active. Now, if I hadn't have done that, it would have said awaiting verification, and that would have sat there until that verification process had gone through. So, sorry? Can you do the same? As in, can you push
power
the...
Push the PowerShell?
Yeah, definitely. You can use the PowerShell to push that through as well. So there is actually some PowerShell, like a PowerShell module you can pull down from the site here. You download it, click it, and yeah, you can run the exact same scripts and you can push it through yourself. So it's definitely something you can do. You know, if you're not happy or comfortable doing PowerShell, then you can just let it wait and see how you go. So the next step here is to pull in some users. Now, this is a simple domain that we're setting up. It's a simple tenant. We don't have an AD. We're simply going to go and import some users and get those up and running so that we can start to get some people going. So I actually have a file sitting locally. Then I'm going to bulk import some users to kick this company up and get it running. So I'm going to go ahead and hit Browse and have a user import CSV here. Now, I'm going to tell you something about the CSV as well. We have a couple of dummy accounts in here that don't have a domain or don't have a Zujo.info or a Zujo.net domain assigned to them. Have those in there to show you that we will actually verify that and show you where those errors are. So you can't add in a dummy account essentially with a bad @microsoft.com type email address. So I'm going to go ahead and hit Next. Verifies the file, and if I have a look at what those errors are, we can see I'm about to pull in an account for Lee, myself, and Chris, all with a Zujo.net email account. And I've got another two down here that are actually saying the name's not valid, and that's because they are contoso@contoso.com email accounts it's trying to assign. We don't have an @contoso.com domain, so we won't allow those to be added because you don't own that. So just to give a heads up on where that's going to sit. So we go ahead and hit Next. I'm going to allow the users to come into the service, select where they exist. Sign the licenses, so this is where I can actually say, what do I want them to have access to? In this case, I'm going to turn on everything, but you know what? I could turn on or off whatever I wanted to there. Hit Next again. It's going to assign the licenses. It's going to send an email out. And then show me a couple of temp passwords. So that's it. That's the first couple of steps for setting up my tenant. Pretty easy, pretty straightforward. I'm now going to hand over to Lee, who's going to take us through some of the Exchange pieces of this and get our mail environment set up.
Cool. Thanks, Ben. It's number one, isn't it, for that one there. Okay. And I think there was a session. Ben, when was 3.10 on? I think that was yesterday.
Yes, so that was yesterday.
So there was a session yesterday where we went into a lot more depth around the identity and access solutions beyond simply just creating users that way, but obviously full dirsync and ADFS and other pieces. Obviously, it's happened now, so if you didn't see it, you need to download it from the TechEd TV or from the website afterwards. So the next step, following on from where Ben took us to, is now we have a working tenant. We have a domain that's verified and validated. We have a handful of users in our service. What we next need to do is start provisioning some real services they can use, and of course, the first cab off the rank, in this case, will be Exchange. And in Exchange world, that means populating their mailboxes with real content and getting that content from an existing mailbox. Before we jump into that, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but just a bit of a level set around what is Exchange Online. There's an expectation, I guess, that you guys understand certainly what Exchange is. And there's probably a misconception that Exchange Online is a subset of Exchange. Exchange Online is Exchange. It's Exchange 2010, Service Pack 1, deployed in the cloud, hosted, managed by us. And so with that, it comes as the fully working Exchange environment. There are a couple of caveats. I know some things that are not included in that, public folders being one and server-side MAPI being the other core piece. But in terms of the functionality, thinking about what end users will experience in terms of calendar, contacts, mail, PIM, free busy, all those kinds of things that we're used to seeing, essentially business class messaging, Exchange Online provides all of that, along with the 25 gig mailbox, as you can see there, and access from a broad range of devices out of the box with no additional charge. That means your Nokia's, any ActiveSync device, your Nokia's, your iPhones, your Windows Mobile Phone 7s, and Androids. So it's a fairly, it's a rich experience. It is the Exchange platform. And in fact, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to jump over to the actual Exchange console and show you that in action. So if I just click number 3. So where we are now, what you'll see here is something that should be very familiar to most of you who, if you're Exchange admins or if you've certainly been playing with Exchange 2010. This is the ECP, the Exchange Control Panel, the web-based administration portal for Exchange as a platform, and Exchange Online. And just before, we're going to go into this in a little bit more depth and have a look around it. But so you understand, Exchange Online can also be managed both through the ECP, through PowerShell set of tools, as well as the Exchange Management Console, the on-premise management tool that you're probably all mostly familiar with, the one that you use today. You can manage Exchange Online through that. You need the Management Console Service Pack 1, and you need a CAS server, a 2010 CAS server in place. that enables you to manage it just like you manage an Exchange server today. So to my point earlier on about this, kind of there's a conception that Exchange Online is a subset in terms of functionality. That's probably born out of a couple of things. Certainly our historical experience with BPOS, the precursor to Office 365, was BPOS did have a limited set of functionality and didn't present to you the rich admin interface that you see here before you. It had a very much scaled down interface. So what you see here in terms of the Exchange 2010 administration side of things, certainly managing mailboxes in the traditional way, as you would expect to see. In fact, if I do a quick refresh on that view here, what we hopefully should see, if all has gone well, of course loading, is those mailboxes that Ben created earlier for me, or the users that Ben created for me, and he's now activating, ready for a piece of work later on. So we can manage users in the traditional way. We can manage distribution groups. And of course, you know, in Exchange 2010, we have the concept of both managed distribution groups, but also self-serve distribution groups. And I'll show you that when I flick to the user side of things and how a user can interact with distribution groups. We'll come back to migration. I'm going to show you that in a little while. Roles and auditing. So administrative roles can now be defined. We can be very clear about things like a person's role around mailbox discovery, for example. In BPOS, in the initial version of this, it was essentially a given statement that the administrator of the service, and certainly the Exchange administrator, had by default full mailbox access rights across everyone's mailbox for administrative purposes. That's no longer the case in Office 365. That is a right that has to be granted, as well as discovery needs to be granted, and you can also then subjugate that up into things like help desk and password management type roles. And of course, all full auditing around that in terms of who has access to what, when, and what they did in that process. Another big area that's new in Exchange, in Office 365 and Exchange Online, is the reintroduction of mail rules, or transport rules, as you probably are more familiar with, and the ability for us to create and manage and maintain a complete set of rules for Exchange Online as well. So whereas you were able to do this Exchange on-prem, you can now do this in Exchange Online. And I kind of get the thinking that, you know, if you're an Exchange administrator in the room, you're looking at this and going, yeah, well, you know, we've been doing that for the last 8 years, at least, so what? The point is, in the Exchange Online world, this is a new statement to be in. This is a level of flexibility that an Exchange administrator expects from Exchange, and we're now delivering an Exchange Online. We're not kind of tying your hands behind your back and giving you no control. And then, of course, domains, as Ben was doing some work yesterday, we've now got all our domain management from an Exchange perspective. And lastly, phone and voice. So I mentioned that we have phone support, two new areas that we have in terms of phone support for Office 365 and Exchange Online. Are critically ActiveSync policies. So now you can both configure and define an ActiveSync policy and allocate individual policies for individual types of users, so types of phones or types of users, however you choose to split that up. And that policy, for those of you who don't know, is as high level as must have PIN or as low level as that user must not enable Bluetooth or camera on that phone and we want to securely encrypt the SD card, and if the phone is lost, we wipe all data off it, including the SD card. We can do that across all ActiveSync 12 plus devices, which includes most of the more modern devices that you see out there across the range. And lastly, unified messaging. So now Exchange Online supports a unified messaging infrastructure that requires you to have that unified messaging infrastructure on-premise, whether that be Exchange or some other third party, but it allows you to do that and integrate that into Office 365 to give you voicemail delivery to the inbox. This is not, as we'll get into a little later on, the link and click to call for voice telephony. This is about delivery of voicemail as a proper voicemail object, not an SMTP mail object, into the mailbox. And of course, the other area that's really changed significantly is the user experience about managing the mailbox. So now as a user, as I flicked over here now, I'm a self-user and not the admin anymore managing my mailbox. I have a much richer experience about my mailbox in terms of what I can do and how I manage my own mailbox and my own rules. Again, stuff that wasn't exposed to users previously. And of course, I mentioned earlier on about groups and how we do group management. So now we have the list serving type model where you can subscribe and unsubscribe to distribution groups yourself in Exchange 2010. But something that was on this site here as well that I didn't talk about is this idea of connected accounts. So Office 365, where it differs from Exchange 2010 on-premise, enables users to connect multiple streams of data or multiple streams of mail into their inbox through this interface here and have all that mail come in to their single inbox, but then also allows them to send out on behalf of those email addresses as well. The critical thing here is, though, that we do a send on behalf of model. So you will see the email. If I have my Hotmail and my IINet and whatever else other emails in here, when I do a send from this, it will be sent from Lee Hicken on behalf of leehicken@zujo.net. But it does enable you to bring all that data into one place. So we'll step away from there for a second. Back to here. There's not enough room on this desk, is there, for all of us? We'll come back to some demo time in a second when we go through the migration piece. I just want to touch on a couple of other pieces of the platform that I can't show you or that we just don't have time to get into. First one is the Forefront piece. So Forefront Online Protection for Exchange, or as FOPI, or however you want to colloquially refer to it, is the antivirus, anti-spam tool set that is wrapped around most of Microsoft's offerings and includes Office 365. So, and that was also the case with BPOS. The big change here with the Office 365 implementation of Forefront is that you are now, the entire Forefront console is visible to you as an administrator. So in BPOS world, it was not visible to you. It was a closed box. You got it. It was on or off. In Office 365, you now have the ability to go into that Forefront console, and it is also federated, so there's no requirement for a second identity through the Exchange admin console, the ECP. There's a button link, take me to Forefront. It'll open up the console for you, and you can manage things as discrete as your spam settings down to very specific switching off and on certain spam features. You can switch off or on certain policy settings. You can create your own policy rules. You can set domain routing lines rules. You can set disclaimers. You can do a whole bunch of stuff now in that FOPI interface, which is provided to you. But additionally, on top of that, one of the big changes in FOPI 10.2, I think, which is the version that comes with Office 365, is this concept of intelligent routing, or flexible mail routing. So we've introduced this idea of MX or smart host or internet-based routing. You can define a whole set of rules that say, for this particular domain, I want mail to behave, or mail inbound, outbound to behave in a certain way. I want to not do policy scanning, but do virus scanning. I want to not do virus scanning, but only do spam filtering. I want to force this mail, regardless of what the MX record says, for this particular domain I'm about to send to, I want you to absolutely send it to that box over there, because we want to do something like DLP protection. We want to do an on-premise piece of PCI compliancy. So we don't do PCI compliancy in the cloud. There are no cloud vendors that offer certified PCI compliancy, but there are a number of appliant devices you can put on-premise, you know, iron port and so on, that will do that for you. So in this scenario now with Office 365, and partially to really to enable that hybrid scenario where you may have Exchange in the cloud and Exchange on-premise or a mail service on-premise, you can have your mail route inbound to on-premise and up to the cloud and be managed that way, and then as it goes outbound, it can go route back out to an on-premise device for cleansing, filtering, whatever you want it to be, for certain domains, so you can pick and choose. So it's very flexible, very open in terms of how you want your mail flow, mail pathing to take place. And it's very easy for you to set up. It's all self-managed. You don't require Microsoft to go do this for you. With Exchange 2010, we introduced the concept of the online archive, death to PSTs. And so the online archiving function is available to you in Exchange 2010 online as well. And that is a function that's available to be attached to a normal mailbox in the cloud, as well as being able to be extend an on-premise mailbox to have an online archive. So for where you have an Exchange on-premise, you're not ready to move all the users yet, but you want to take advantage of the cheap service disk space that we're offering, you're looking at things like Enterprise Vault and on-premise other services to kind of bulk up that vaulting of data. We can offer you an online archive attached to an on-premise mailbox, as well as a fully managed archive in the cloud. That archive is, and I say in inverted commas because I don't want to ever be called up on it, it is unlimited in size. We don't put any limit on what you can store there or how much data you can store there. It is simply paid for as a subscription-style approach, just like the mailbox as well. And you can apply retention policies and long-term legal hold, so 7 to 10 year admissible evidence legal hold on that data with full discovery rules and multi-mailbox searching across that as well. It is part of the E3 licensing.
Sorry, which one was that?
The archiving is part of the E3 license, yes. And you need to be an E3 license to do it.
So archiving comes in two flavors. I'm going to yell. Actually, hold on. Calm down.
There's a mic under there.
Yell. We yell as much as we can.
Yes. The minimum requirement is something called Exchange Plan 2, which is included in that E3 and E4 licensing, but it's not natively included in the E3 product.
Correct. So, sorry, now I have a mic. So the easiest way to describe this, there are two versions of archiving. You have a 25 gig inbox with Exchange Online. One version of the archiving is basically uses that pool of 25 gig of data.
Yep.
So you could say you have 10 gig worth of active mail, and another 15 gig worth of archive. That's what's default in Exchange Plan 2. That's the archiving inbuilt in E3. There is an additional add-on archiving that is unlimited in the amount of storage and how long you can store it and all those types of things. So that's why we kind of can get a little bit confusing with the archiving side of things.
The important thing to note with the second option, the unlimited long-term archive, is that is the only one that offers legal hold. The one that Ben is referring to is is not legal hold. Users can edit, manipulate, manage, and destroy the data. In legal hold, they cannot touch the data. It is stored in an invisible storage outside of the user's mailbox area. And the last bit, which I sort of touched on briefly there, is this idea of rich coexistence, or certainly deployment flexibility. One thing we've clearly learned from the analyst world and from experience from customers is that hybrid or a deployment model that spans both the cloud and your existing on-premises infrastructure is where most customers want to be or need to be, for functionality reasons or simply from a risk perspective, they want to minimize that risk. And so we offer that rich coexistence experience now with Office 365. About having sharing content, sharing free busy data. So a full fidelity experience. You can have an Exchange server in the cloud, your Exchange server on-premise with a CAS server in between. That is the requirement, a 2010 Service Pack 1 CAS server on top of any Exchange platform 2003 and above will provide you with a full fidelity infrastructure where mail can flow back and forth. Users can free busy between each other. They essentially belong to the same Exchange. It's like having two forests, but same. They work in trust together. Now, with that rich coexistence model that we just touched on comes a model of mailed migration, which is referred to as essentially rich migration, where there was a session yesterday that Toby Knight did, one of my colleagues, which allows you to do something called drag-and-drop mailboxing, where you can simply move a mailbox from on-premise to the cloud, and just like any normal mailbox migration, the user makes no changes, their profile remains intact, their outlook is untouched, they're simply redirected by auto-discover records, and that user's mailbox suddenly resides in the cloud, and all the user has to do is kind of restart Outlook, and it will refigure its auto-discover path. Very, very simple, very, very easy, but requires some infrastructure to do so. As I mentioned, the CAS server requires you to have Exchange on-premise, requires you to set this up and manage it. There is an alternative way of doing that, and that's what we're going to explore today, which is the concept of simple migration. And simple migration consists of Exchange 2003 and above, and 2007 and 10, as well as IMAP-based mail migration. So whether you're coming from an existing Exchange infrastructure or an other mail service, providing you have an IMAP interface into that, then we can start to migrate that mail across. These are about enabling very fast cutovers, but they come with some cost, which we'll explore now. So the idea of this cutover Exchange migration, if we think about a smaller organization that simply wants to take that can take that weekend hit and says, okay, we're going to kind of go offline, so to speak, for a weekend. We're going to move all our mailboxes over, and it's very simple for us to do that, and we don't need to kind of we don't need to establish all this extra infrastructure. Or we're not running on Exchange right now, we're running on another mail service. We just want to suck the data out of one, squeeze it into the other, and get started on our new platform. It does provide, in the right scenarios, a high-fidelity migration. We'll explore what that means and what content and data does get migrated. And it does support migration from pretty much any kind of mailbox, assuming that IMAP support is out there or Exchange is the platform you have. But there are some requirements in the Exchange world. So first of all, if you are coming from an existing Exchange platform, if you're on 2003 or 2007 and above, you'll need to enable Outlook Anywhere. So Outlook Anywhere is the RPC of a HTTPS model that we enable. So on Outlook Exchange 2003, that means setting up RPC and RPC proxies. Exchange 2007 and above, you obviously switch this on and you've got auto-discover in place to help you do this. You need to have that on. And in order to do that, those of you who have that, you'll know you need to establish a certificate on the server to do that. And it needs to be a public cert because we will only trust a public cert for your connection to us. We won't trust your private certs. You also need to give a user, an administrator, full mailbox access to all the mailboxes in order to facilitate that process, because you're going to provide an admin account at that time to get the transition kicked off, to get the process kicked off. And that's true of both IMAP and of Exchange migrations. So I'll get the bad stuff over with first of all. What doesn't get migrated? What won't we do in this? And this is not necessarily the case for the rich migration. Rich migrations will do some of these things. But in the simple or cutover migration, we don't do partial migrations. That's for a start. So in a simple migration, you drag everything across. It's a start, wait, finish, moved on to the new platform. There's no picking and choosing. If you want to do a partial migration, but still want to do this simple model, you don't want to go into the rich coexistence world, then all you need to do is implement a piece of infrastructure called DirSync, which I'm sure Toby would have talked about yesterday, or you'll get some more details on from, we would have had some more details from his session. DirSync simply syncs your AD to our AD, and that allows you to do blocks of users. The point being is that until you do that DirSync, we really don't know who your users are, so we have to do a full migration. We can't just pick and choose which ones to do. We don't do dynamic distribution lists. In fact, that's a blanket statement across the service right now. We don't support dynamic distribution lists in Exchange Online. They don't get migrated over. We don't migrate security groups, but we do support security groups in Exchange Online. So you can create them up in the cloud, but we don't migrate them over in this tool. The Rich Migration Service will do that. So your mailbox GUIDs aren't preserved. We are creating a whole new mailbox. Certain folders and things will, and certain time ranges we can't do. It's very much a pick your time, pick your mailboxes, and start syncing them all over. But in terms of the fidelity of the mailbox and what's inside of it, from a mail perspective, it's pretty much rich formatting across everything. Delivery reports, NDRs, your read receipts and non-read receipts, all your rules, any folders, categories you've set, flags, status, everything about that mailbox will get transferred over. Obviously, we're making an assumption here that you're coming from Exchange with a lot of this because these are Exchange-specific attributes. So you'll get a full fidelity. You won't lose any. Users won't be coming in on Monday morning and wondering why all their email is now unread, where it was all clean and read before. In terms of the calendar side of things, again, good, rich fidelity of migration. All of your calendar items, and probably most importantly, meeting requests and recurrences, cancellations, responses, any exceptions, and your out-of-office settings, where applicable, will be transferred over. So again, no real loss of fidelity there, very rich experience for users. And beyond that, yes, all the things that you, the other PIM data that's embedded in there, your tasks, notes, contacts, any delegates you've set, all of that content, that will all come across, including permissions and everything else. So you can pretty much say that, you know, in a sort of small environment, this is a very quick and simple way to get a full fidelity migration happening. And the only thing that you are time constrained on in this kind of migration is the physics of your network and how much data can you move from A to B, from your site to our site during that time. So the things to consider when doing this is the time window you're doing it in terms of network impact, and certainly your Exchange server, how well connected is that to the internet, and is there any way that you can open up additional connections during that time to simply allow that Exchange server to squirt more data out. As you'll see when we do the when I go to the demo now, you can define how many connections and how many active mailboxes at a time concurrently will be migrated. So the more pipes you have, the more network you have, the more you can open that up and migrate more content at the same time. The end user experience throughout all of this, however, because we are essentially doing a mailbox move, we are not managing, we are not transferring the user from a server to a server, we are just moving their content, and the user is a whole new user in the two experiences in the two environments. We need new passwords for the user. They are logging into a new service. Ben is conveniently hiding all that pain from you right now because he's logging into that account that he just created for me with that password you saw him create, which would, of course, be different than the password that I had on-premise prior to that point. So there is a passwords distribution process to be done. The user will then log in with a new profile and everything is fine. Yeah, they're going to log in and auto-discover connected to the online service. The OST resync in this particular scenario is unavoidable. The user will resync their mailbox down and you have to get that data redown. In the rich coexistence model I mentioned where you've got the ability with a CAS server and a drag and drop, that OST resync does not occur because the mailbox ID, the profile, and GUIDs remain intact. But in this scenario, they're not, so you will have to resync data. So that's something else to consider is, you know, if you've got large mailboxes, that's data up and data down in that process. So lastly, yes, IMAP, because that's what we're going to look at now. So when we're looking at IMAP, and you could, of course, use the IMAP against Exchange if you so choose to as well, but we don't recommend it. But the IMAP, as with any of the migrations, largely requires no on-premise tools at all. We are going to go connect directly to the IMAP service and send the data straight over to the cloud. Nothing takes place on-premise. You need access to the IMAP ports. Most of the traditional mail services in the cloud offer those, open those up for you. And we'll go through this. We're going to do a bulk user. It's basically a bulk CSV type import where you gather all the information about the users and squirt that data in. It does IMAP folder traversal, so it will start at the slash root and work its way down through all the folders in that IMAP tree for each individual user. And we do that through the CSV file. So I'll pull that CSV file up now, and we can have a look at that process. So if I flick over to me again, number three. So still back in the admin console here, in Exchange admin console, I'll go back to managing my organization, my users. Now, mailboxes. Sorry, email migration, which is the tab over here. So again, in BPOS previous to this, we actually had the migration tools were a separate set of tools you downloaded and installed on a local machine, which required you to have a number of local machines in order to run a very scaled migration. We've now embedded those in the service here, so you don't require any of that infrastructure on-premise. So it becomes as simple as clicking on what I'd like to do, a new migration. Where do you want to migrate from? And we make the choices. Obviously, if you choose to do something like Exchange, then what we're going to ask you for is the domain, username, password, and for the administrator. And how many mailboxes would you like to sync, migrate synchronously? We can do defaults 3, you can do up to 10. With Exchange 2003, it's slightly different, but the same concept. We just need the RPC proxy data in order to connect through to get access to that. And in the IMAP world, it is as simple as knowing the IMAP server, so imap.gmail.com. Basic settings for that. There we go. So do I want to exclude any folders from this particular migration? I'm not going to. I have to say, Ben and my colleagues here on the stage had the beauty and the luxury of being able to test this prior to doing this in the demo, in the rehearsals. I have not had a chance to test this. You can't do it until the mailbox is created. I only hope that Ben has created my mailbox for me and all is good. And away we go. Let me just quickly show you this. The Gmail import file, it is a fairly straightforward, simple text file, just like the ones that Ben was showing in terms of the CSV. Name of the email address you're about to create, the username on the IMAP service, and the password from that service. Please don't go and spam me. My Gmail account is full of spam already. Click to that. Click next. And it simply goes, it validates the mail, the file, determines, yes, I've got one row, it's been uploaded by me, and when it's finished, it'll send a report to this particular user and tells me where it's going to come from. And I click run. And all being well, that goes away. And what you see here now on the console is the migration service running. So this is what's interesting and unique about the service. In the current version of Exchange Online, you can only have one migration running at a time. In the next iteration of this, in our future service release of this, you'll actually be able to run multiple of these migrations at the same time. But what's happening is the migration runs as a constant, continuous background process on our servers. So no on-premise requirements. But it's constantly now reading and feeding from that Gmail account of mine. The first thing it will do, of course, is the initial sync, and it will start pulling that data over into the mailbox. But then it stays continually checking that mailbox. So as mail is still being delivered to my Gmail inbox, it'll be delivered and then received and then fed over to my online Office 365 mailbox. So as a user, once the migration is kicked off, at any time I want to, I can now be migrated over to the online service. My mailbox is now hopefully on its way, being filled up. Ben's not smiling, so things are good. Do you want to flick over to it so we can see? So the mailbox is now starting to fill up with all of that spam from my Google mailbox, and it will stay that way. And so as users now, we've started to migrate all our users over to the online service. I'm Lee Higgins now on, sitting on here. My mail's still being delivered from Google. And at some point in the future, when we're comfortable and confident that everybody's happy with the experience, the content, and their mail flow, we can, of course, stop the migration, sever the links, and ensure that, obviously, from that point on, the users set up their mail address and everybody knows this is their new mail address. The challenging thing with an IMAP migration like this, typically with an Exchange one, you're probably coming from the same domain to this domain. In the IMAP world, we might be seeing scenarios where people are coming from lee@bigpond.com or lee@mycompany.bigpond.com or something that isn't necessarily the domain they want to use. And in the Office 365 world, they'll have registered their proper business domain and they're moving off some kind of free mail server. So they'd need to manage that, hey, this is now my new identity, which means you might need to leave the migration running longer for those guys because there's probably a longer window of mail getting lost along the way. No, you can leave this running for as long as you want. I mean, the only limit is, are you really getting the best out of the scenario? You're sort of sitting in this. Well, yeah, so the only limit would be how long you're willing to pay for the old service if it was something like a paid BigPond or service. Obviously, in this scenario from Gmail, I could just leave this running constantly, and it will just continue to come through. But yes, it works fine, and again, just the proof is in the pudding, just to make sure you're absolutely see. That's my Gmail account, and as you saw, that was the other one. So it's a mirror of each other. It is absolutely the right content coming through. So that hopefully gives you a good view of the fact that it is a very, very simple thing to do. And granted, that was an IMAP one, very straightforward. Most of you may be coming from an Exchange environment. The process is exactly the same. The only things are the validations are a bit more points and checks around ensuring that domains are set correctly and you are doing what you want to do all of your users. And it's more about the timing issues, but it is that simple to migrate across. So my last leaving point, when I'll hand over to Chris to get into the SharePoint, is really you've kind of got two key choices. If I want to go down the simple migration, simple coexistence path, then what you've just seen is the way you'd go and put dirsync in place and make that life a little bit easier. If I want to go for that rich coexistence, you do need the CAS server. You do need to be coming from an Exchange 2003 or above, but with the 2010 CAS server, and then you get the rich fidelity without any OST resync across the way. And with that, Chris, I'll hand it over to you to talk about SharePoint.
I'm on. Yes. Hello. All right.
Now, one of the key pieces with the Office 365 stack, of course, is SharePoint Online. And this is a big move ahead from the BPOS scenario, which was the previous version, the SharePoint 2007 environment. So we've seen Lee talking about the Exchange stuff and the actual provisioning and the multi-tenant sort of aspect of it. What I'm going to run through is a little bit around the SharePoint piece of Office 365. Obviously, it's going to depend on the particular workloads that you're wanting to do and what you want to move up to the cloud. My Sites is a great way to store all your documents and storage, and a couple of organisations are choosing to move all their documentation and personal documents and such, and a 500 meg file size, move that up to the cloud, get that off-premise. And, of course, Team Sites, which is SharePoint bread and butter, is sort of collaboration, portal, workflow forms and all the rest of that. Internet sites as well, if you're needing to engage with other organisations. Extranet as well, so that you can have a common place to collaborate with people outside of your organisation, rather than have to set up firewall rules and VPN and all the rest of that. And websites, of course. How many people were in the session yesterday? Ben was sort of touching on that the website aspect of Office 365 and the SharePoint piece is not a full-fledged public-facing e-commerce style site. I want to dispel a few myths with that, so I'm going to do a full demo of that with our Zujo.net environment, so we'll see that in a moment. One of the good things with Office 365 is, and SharePoint Online, is that it's pretty much everything you get. There's a lot of sort of myth around, you know, that you don't get this and you don't get that within the Office 365 area of SharePoint Online. Not really true. There's pretty much, the best way to say it is you get everything. You get everything out of SharePoint 2010, except for a few things. And those few things that you don't get are fast search, which is the multi-tenant story. Again, if you've got searching for documents, because they can't, Microsoft can't secure down to a tenant level with the fast product functionality, you would get other documents from other companies, other vendors, potentially competition. So that's not a good thing. That's coming down the track. BCS as well, business connectivity services, so that you can hook out to a back-end system and the rest. There are other ways you can do that. You could have a Silverlight control, for instance, that could call off-domain down to your local store, or a sandbox solution as well. And Performance Point, the BI component within SharePoint, that's not allowed or not available as yet on the Office 365 SharePoint Online. There are some BI components, and we'll see those in a minute, but they're just sort of lesser level, they're KPI sort of level, as opposed to full-fledged business intelligence Performance Point stuff. And yeah, as I mentioned, no full trust code. And I guess that's one thing, I'm a developer background, and developers, SharePoint developers, have traditionally been fairly spoilt with sort of full access. I need to deploy some code, drop some files in the GAC, deploy WSP, admin rights, do that on your dev VM, and then do it on a production VM. Kind of bad practice. So I guess the message now is sandbox solutions. You can deploy code within sandbox solutions, but rather than think outside the box, you've got to think inside the box. What can I do within those bounds of that tenant that that I'm allowed to do? And of course, rethink, use jQuery, for instance, and the JavaScript client object model, stuff that you can do in the browser, not DLLs. If you get into C#, you've got some problems there, and or some caveats around sandbox. There's a couple of sessions later on, I think later today or tomorrow, talking about, Ben's doing a session later today, about the sandbox solution, Visual Studio, and how to get that up to SharePoint Online. As we saw earlier with the slide around the multi-tenancy, you've got this apartment sort of view. You don't get a central admin. Traditionally, SharePoint, you log into central admin, you've got all your different service apps, all your profile imports and all the rest of that, the full swag of how to control your SharePoint site. The console, as we've seen, and we'll show in a moment, is you manage SharePoint, but you get a limited set of stuff that you can do. You have that bit in the red there, the tenant administration. You can do stuff around site collections, create site collections, delete site collections, and all the rest of that, and a few other functions, central admin-y. But there's a lot of stuff that is abstracted away into a Microsoft central admin that we as companies, as customers, just don't get access to. And again, that's the multi-tenancy sort of side of things. Of course, you can set up all your site collections, My Sites, user profile import, manage metadata as well, term store stuff. That's really good. And you can configure, to a limited extent, the forms, InfoPath form services, really just turning it on and off for a browser-based. As I mentioned before, the customization and the configuration, green, yellow, and red, sort of escalating in complexity and availability of what you can do. Obviously, out of the box, SharePoint, you can do web parts. There's some Visio-based workflows, SharePoint designer-based workflows, and listen libraries. You can do pretty much anything you can do in SharePoint on-premise. You can do SharePoint in the browser for SharePoint Online. Then you get into the next level, which is the SharePoint Designer sort of level. Connect up with SharePoint Designer and hook up to your site and set up your master page, your page layouts, CSS and all the rest of that. And no-code workflows, of course, your Visio, setting up a Visio-based diagram and uploading that to SharePoint Designer and publishing that up to the cloud. So there's a lot you can do. Of course, then, yeah, development level stuff, which is sandbox solutions, Silverlight and the client object model, and using the web services to get in and out of SharePoint Online. Another sort of aspect to consider is that there's other vendors, other third-party contributors now to the ecosystem within Office 365. Nintex, which is the on-premise workflow engine, has some Nintex Live components now which can pull and push files and documents to Office 365. And they're one of the first companies in the world to have an agreement with Microsoft that if you have a dedicated Office 365 server, they've got a green light to install Nintex on the cloud box, up in the cloud. So ways and means that you can get workflow going and interacting with your documents and files within the cloud. AvPoint as well, one of the major sponsors for TechEd, they've got some tools that allow you to migrate your content up to the cloud. If you've got documents and Excel spreadsheets and Word documents and all the rest of that, getting that up to the portal, so migrating up to the cloud. And there's some other third-party vendors as well. Kalinda Software have got a micro-blogging and sort of interaction with other people in the organisation, sort of Facebook for the enterprise kind of stuff. And then there's Skylight Systems as well, have got an XRM, like a CRM, XRM sort of solution that can run on-premise, and they've got a 365 story for that as well. And of course, there's the Office 365 marketplace, so there's stuff coming all the time. So it's not just Microsoft saying, we're all in. There's other companies who are betting on it too. All right, so let's have a look at SharePoint Online. I'm going to set up a few bits and pieces around our SharePoint site for Zujo.net, and I'll have to log in because I timed out. Okay, so this is the online services landing page. So I've just gone portal.microsoft.online.com, and it's loaded me up to the site here. I've logged in as Chris O'Connor at Zujo.net, and I see all the bits and pieces around what I can manage for my tenant. I'm going to have a look at SharePoint Online, and this is central admin for Office 365. As you see, there's only a few options here. I've got Manage Site Collections, Configure Info Path, and Manage User Profiles and Term Store, which is your managed metadata. The main area, I suppose, that I'm going to focus on is the site collection, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to provision two site collections. As we mentioned, Office 365 has this public-facing site as a more of a brochureware sort of site, and we'll have a look at that. So I'm going to configure up a site collection from our public site for Zujo.net and make sure that we can do a quick demo of what the public-facing site is. So I will call it Zujo. And it's creating a site collection. So it's essentially the same sort of thing. There's a URL. I'll leave that as is. You can't change it. So and time and all the rest of that. Who's the administrator? I'll put myself as the administrator. Zujo.net. Oops. Is it C. O'Connor? Okay. Yeah.
All this stuff in real time.
The beach ball spinning, waiting.
So it's proof that we're running in a real environment, and this was provisioned recently. Am I actually on? No, I'm on. There we go. Okay. So yeah, proof that we're actually running in a real environment, and it has been set up in real time. There is a bit of time for the accounts to propagate across to each of the services, which is probably why this hasn't come through yet.
Let's see.
Just chuck admin in there.
Is it admin?
Yeah.
Admin boss?
Admin boss, yeah.
There we go. Okay. I need an admin user and a quota. Let's do... we'll do 5 gig. This is for a public site, remember, so we probably don't need anywhere near that. But what we're seeing now is that it's provisioning a public-facing site. So Zujo2011-web.sharepoint.com. And in a while, that'll come live, and you guys can all see it. And actually, we're going to have a bit of a competition. We've got a headset here, so keep an eye on that site over the next half an hour, and there might be some clues as to how to win that. Next thing I'm going to do is just do a private site collection, which will be for people that have to be a member of the Zujo.net organisation, at the moment us three, and our admin boss. Again, same sort of thing when you're creating a SharePoint site, a SharePoint site collection within the organisation. And this one we could call it, we'll just call it TechEd. Same sort of thing, you can give it a sites URL, and it'll be zujo2011.sharepoint.com, sites, and then TechEd. And pretty much like SharePoint on-premise, you get to choose your template. So this is all familiar to people who are SharePoint administrators, SharePoint consultants. You've got a variety of different types of SharePoint site collections. Publishing is the only sort of area that's not supported at the moment, obviously with this public-facing site, but we'll just create a team site. And again, we'll put in admin boss, because he's the one we like at the moment. It's authenticating, is it? It was admin boss, wasn't it?
Yep.
I'm going to go into the search like I did last time. Okay. Admin boss. Ooh. It's thinking. What's happened to it? Okay, let's try that one more time. Admin boss, and there's our tenant, and click OK. Let's see if it'll just resolve as I click OK. Oh, that's there we go. We are demoing live. Okay, we have another site collection there, and I'll go and have a look actually, because let's just SharePoint Online, and we'll have a look at another demo that we've got, Fabricam, which is one of the pre-baked SharePoint site collections running on the cloud. But while that web one there is spinning up, and that's spun up already, that's great. So what we can do is refresh maybe. Who's booting me out? Bear with me one sec.
You said admin is the user.
Oh, I'm glad I have Exchange as my
account. Yeah.
Login is the admin account.
I had that before. What is it? Admin boss.
Admin at
zujo2011.com. Pass at word one. Okay, so we've got our public site there that's spinning up. We'll come back and have a look at that, and we'll do the page edit and all the rest of that. But what I wanted to show quickly was this is an Office 365 site that Microsoft have put together, just to show and tell sort of the, you know, that you can do a fair bit and have a really good extranet, intranet sort of styled product. So this doesn't really look like SharePoint. Well, it is, does to a little degree. You've got your navigation across the top, navigation down the side. But if I have a look into some of the areas within the site, we can, you know, SharePoint Online, you can do a lot. You can do 99% of the functionality that you're used to. I'm going to get authored again. Oh, it's because I'm back and forth. No, it's not. This is the other one, isn't it? Bear with me, I just got to check on the this is not actually our Zujo.net site, this is our Fabricam one, so it's a different set of credentials, that's why it's thrown me out. Okay, so if I start a hardware request, this is loading an InfoPath form. Now this has been designed in InfoPath 2010, published up to the site, forms library and all the rest of that, and so this is just SharePoint. SharePoint Online. If we have a look now over at our marketing site, marketing has some KPIs in there. So there's a bunch of indicators. These are key performance indicators driven off a SharePoint list. And we've got a team discussion as well and a note board as well so that we can continue our discussion within the organisation. Documents and all the rest of that. If we have a look at product documents, one of the cool things here is that we're using Office web apps. So that we've got some links at the top here that if I want to create a new document, I've got my content types for a start, but it's going to create that particular document in giving me a name, and then it will open up in the online 2001, that's so 10 years ago. 2011, and that's creating it using the Office web app. So a really cool user environment that that people can use. Fairly familiar as well, SharePoint. So, well, they can open it up in Microsoft Word, so you can edit away and save the document, and that'll save back to the portal. And I'm just using a browser. This is using Internet Explorer.
I was using Firefox, if anyone noticed, by the way.
Lee was using Firefox. He just wanted to call that out. Okay, so that's kind of cool, but let's have a look at the public-facing site. So if I take a copy of this URL and jump over to... This is the public-facing site within within Office 365. So you get a kind of a template-y look to the site. Not fantastic, but we'll configure this up and make it look good.
I think the key thing is here, too, is if you head on over to zujo2011-web.sharepoint.com, yes, intuitive, we know, you will be able to actually see this stuff happening live. You won't be authed. It's a public-facing website, so feel free to spin this up on your laptops as we go. You can have a look at stuff as we're making our way through as well.
No, I must be mentioned to admin boss.
Too many accounts to do.
Yeah,
different demos
juggling users and accounts and passwords and all the rest of that. Admin at, is it Microsoft? Is it Microsoft Online?
At zujo2011.onmicrosoft.com.
Onmicrosoft.com. There we go. All right. That should get us in there. Great. All right. So this is what you get. This is the administration sort of area for the site. You get four default pages, and as we saw in the actual, if I bring it up in sort of a, let's bring it up in Firefox, just again as, no, I don't want to update Firefox every 5 minutes. So this will be an anonymous view of the same site. So there we go. There's the About Us, Contact Us, Sitemap, and a member login, which is, I'm logged in over here on my IE view. Whoops. So, what I'm going to do is if I go into pages, you get a ribbon. Let's create a new page. And let's do a, what do we do? Products or services. This is a fairly, it's a wizard-based environment. And you get a few options. You can get to choose your header and your footer and your navigation bar and all the rest of that. So it sort of leads people through to creating a site. It's getting a presence on the web. As we said, it's not an e-commerce site by any stretch of the imagination, but you get a fairly flexible, fairly editable environment.
Just to be clear, what you're seeing here is available in both the small business edition of Office 365 as well as the full enterprise product that Chris is working in right now.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to change some of the themes and the colours here just to make it look a little different and more like the Zujo brand. And we'll save a couple of these away. So, body, site background, same again. This is just to sort of show and tell the way in which you can set up your site, your branding and all the rest of that. Secondary colour is CEC. I've got a cheat sheet here, obviously, because I don't remember hex colours. Why did that not touch? CEC4. Apply. Okay. I can set the colours for my navigation and all the rest of that. You could do this with a style sheet as well, but the good thing is that once this is done for the site, it's done for the site, so I don't need to worry about it. So I'll do a couple of these. Just to do... Okay. And now my theme, I can change my navigation as well. I can put my navigation just to the top and to the left. I'm just going to have it to the top. And here, let's load up a logo. This is our Zujo.net logo. And theme, I don't want style, I don't want
we have a look back over at our public site, it's changed up and we've got some of our colours and our heading and the rest of that. Now, I don't want my text. There's a couple of different ways you can set up the branding, I guess, for the site. Again, not hugely important, but good to show, good to demo. So what we'll do next is, again, for this brochureware kind of site where you're wanting to have a presence on the web, what we can do is let's add in a few bits and pieces around, let's add in some gadgets. There's these gadgets here which are really, really cool. I'm on a products page, so I want to add in a slideshow. Now, I've got a slideshow album, which is, find more images. There's my find more images. Select the image. No, there's my library select. It's called product images. That's the name of my library. Why am I not getting my images there? Okay, we might come back to that in a sec because Ben's just uploading the images into our images gallery, and we'll show the image rotator there. The good thing with this is that you can quickly and easily get up some really cool stuff. I can add up the Contact Us page. And you'll see that that's great. That's added me a Contact Us site. So if we have a look back over, and if you guys want to refresh, have a look at our Contact Us. There's a product page now. Products. This is live. This is public. This is on the web. So that's quick and easy for people to get a presence on the web, brochureware as it would be. We've got some colours, some fonts, and all the rest of that. Another cool thing I really like with these gadgets, if we save that one and we go back to one of the other pages, Contact Us, for instance. Let's have a look at the Contact Us site. And for Zujo, here we are. Let's add in a Bing map. Insert a gadget. Gadgets, go gadgets, maps. Now for Australia, let's put in 1,000
and the gadget library that he's pulling the gadgets from is an extensible library. So we have an area called the Office 365 Community Marketplace. Don't say App Store. But we have kind of an app store where third-party vendors will be able to create and upload and provide gadgets at either a cost or free, however they choose to do that commercially, for you to include in your public website. So it's not limited to what you're seeing here. Mm-hmm. There are a number more that can be added in, and you can be creating them yourselves.
They're not really web parts. No, they're more sort of, well, they're gadgets, but they're essentially pieces of HTML and there's some pretty cool stuff happening behind the scenes.
We've got PayPal in there already, and obviously
I won't have a look at this source, but some video slideshow. Let's go back to our slideshow and we'll leave our products page, which is at the moment is our Contact Us. I'll take out the Contact Us. Oh, yep. Ben has just whispered in my ear that he has changed the products page to have our products. Silverlight control. Click on an image and you've got some play and rotate, full screen sort of thing, so you can skip between your images and all the rest of that. I mean, I haven't done anything fancy. I haven't uploaded any code, anything like that. This is just using the out-of-the-box stuff that you get with the public-facing site. Number of different templates for how you want to lay out your page to have, and some suggestions as well. And as we saw when I created a couple of pages, you've got some different types of pages as well when you go to create it. So that's the public-facing site. I mean, that's essentially what you get. You can upload documents, obviously, and link to them from within your other pages. But, I mean, there's a fair amount that you can do, but that's it. That's the public-facing site. So as far as SharePoint Online goes, We had a look at Fabricam, so a whole heap of stuff that you can do within, it's just SharePoint. There's a couple of caveats to that. Obviously, fast, you can't do in multi-tenancy. BCS, you can't do. Sandbox code, you've got to think inside the box. And a public-facing site, which is sort of this brochureware presence on the web. But as I say, if you have a look at that site now, that's live, and there'll be some bits and pieces. If you click about, you might actually work out how to win this prize.
Okay.
Nearly there? There we are. Okay, so we're nearly done. We have two more things to show you, which is all about getting his tenant set up and ready. So Chris has got our SharePoint site up, Lee has our Exchange set up, and we've got the tenant set up and a domain registered. So the last two things we're going to look at very quickly are Office and Link to make sure that we've got the full experience happening here. So again, probably saw this slide yesterday. Office Professional Plus is included as part of the subscription. You get all these products. We also have Office Web Apps as part of the SharePoint model as well. I'm not going to go over this slide in more detail because I know we're strapped for time. What I'm actually going to do is jump straight into the demo side of things instead and start to show you what the difference is when we're looking at activating Office in the online world. So let me do a quick flick over here. All right, so I have my laptop here that I've installed a copy of Office that I downloaded from the Office 365 admin portal. And basically what I've got up is a command window that is showing you the tool that you can use to do licensing and those kind of things. But what I really want to show you here is, is the activation experience. And literally all this is going to do at the moment is it's going to flush my licensing cache and then ask me to reactivate. So no more of this 25-character key kind of entry that you're giving out to someone, because all it's going to need is my online credentials to be able to activate. While that's going through, I'm also going to flick over to Link and show you that I now have that set up and running as well. So in the background, you probably saw both Chris and I tapping away feverishly to try and get some things up and running. What we were doing was actually setting up the Link clients on these machines with this newly provisioned environment. So Link's all about IM presence, being able to instant message and start up voice conversations with people. And you can see I now have this spun up, ready to go. It's live, it's up and running. And I have myself signed in on this PC, and I have Lee signed in on this one over here. So just to prove that this is a real world example, we can go, hey, Lee.
I better go over and do something, hadn't I?
Yeah, that'd be good. There we go. And now Lee's going to actually message me back.
We got a winner.
Wow, that was quick.
That was quick. Jeez. Come down afterwards and we'll have
that's good. Out. It's helping us with time, right? So we like that idea. So this is all point-to-point communications at the moment. It's just between Lee and myself. However, if I wanted to then go and take this into a conference, I could drag Chris into that and we can have a three-way conversation. And so now we have the service or the Link service online there taking care of that management side of things to manage everything together. Lee's going to spin up some video conferencing as well, so we'll probably see that come through shortly. So we can literally get all of this up and running, within what is this hour, and we'll let that video come through as that's going.
It's definitely up here. It's your network.
So again, maybe multiple demos all running at once. We'll get all that going, so we'll switch back to Office when we get while we're doing that. This is the activation experience that you'll see for end users who install a copy of Office they pull down from Office 365. Literally a matter of coming in, putting in my online services ID, and then putting in my password. And it's that simple. My copy of Office is now activated. It's going to go through and verify the subscription and make sure everything's good. So at the moment, it's actually talking to the service, doing that nice little activation process. And once that happens, my copy of Office will activate. Now, the great thing about this model is that if you have an employee that leaves and they install this copy of Office on their own PC, when you take that license away, their copy of Office goes into the reduced functionality mode. So that means that they can start to, you can start to take those licenses, reassign them, not be worried about being out of compliance with licensing or anything along those lines as part of that. So it makes that a lot easier to manage from that side of things. Now, video is still having a bit of an issue connecting. I think it's on my side. It's the white screen of Linkness. So there we go. So that's basically our environment from absolutely nothing that we started with at the start of this session, all the way up to a fully running environment with mail.
Mailbox migrated
as well, and also bought up all the other services we needed around SharePoint, Exchange, and the Office client and Link to get that full experience. This is enterprise-grade software, all running within an hour, not something you'd normally get to see. And our public-facing website as well as part of that. So that really brings us to the end of our demo for today. Thank you to the person who was very, very sharp on getting their prize.
And
please make sure you come down and collect your headset. Other than that, I think we
have 5 minutes left, so we're more than happy to take questions or abuse.
Yep.
But other than that, we appreciate your time and the tweets, and enjoy the party tonight. And clap, please clap. That's it. Thank you.